Hello again and welcome to Reality Check. I'm Jeannie Allen. Our guest on this edition is Beth Anderson, the founder and CEO of the highly successful and innovative Phoenix Charter Academy Network. I have been so looking forward to having Beth on the program for several months because she's truly an education pioneer, and because we have this kindred philosophy in life and our mission, which is really to disrupt the status quo. Beth, I don't think you would disagree that what you're doing today and have done for so many kids is disrupting the status quo and making lives better for them. So with that, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jean. It's a pleasure and an honor to be on the show. And as I told you before, it's my first podcast, so I feel excited to have another first in my life. And yes, you are 100% right that we are trying to be the best disruptor we can inside of a educational establishment that needs to look at how it is serving all children better. I would say if only Phoenix should be even more disruptive. And so more on that to come.
Yeah, so no, I definitely want to talk about that. So let's bring our listeners kind of up to speed first about who you are and then jump into a little bit more about Phoenix Academy, which, of course, I've got lots of reasons to love. And that kind of pictorial in my head of Up from the Ashes, which really says it all. Mm-hmm. But first, you've been a teacher since 1991.
So I was a teacher in 1991 until about 1995 in South Central Los Angeles, and I was a member of the second core ever of Teach for America, and that, you know, was sort of the start of everything for me. I just graduated from Brandeis. I had a job offer from Teach for America and a near job offer from Staples. And I didn't know which way I was going to go. And I was very, very compelled by the inspirational work of Wendy Kopp, and nobody had heard of it. It had a tiny little byline in Time magazine, and I said, let's try it. I'm only 22. I got a lot of time. And I had no idea at the time that it would be the thing that would really launch, which I think will end up being 3/4 of my life at some point.
It's a fascinating story. It's one that's increasingly coming to the attention of the public. In fact, it used to be there were hundreds of you. Now there are literally thousands of mm-hmm. leaders who started somewhere, weren't sure where they were going, and both because of their passion, commitment, and education, if you will, realized that they could do something more for kids. What is it that you thought you could do based on your experience that ended up being Phoenix?
I think, so the experience of being a core member in South Central was life-altering for me. And I say that not just geographically, being an East Coast girl and moving west and then working in a community that was more diverse by language and race than I had ever had the privilege of you know, walking into before. And I was always an activist at heart. So, like, whether it was, you know, promoting an agenda of women's rights within my own home in Carver, Massachusetts, or working with my mother on American Red Cross blood drives, or some of the other work that we did, I always wanted to be sort of somebody that would try to make the world better. So, you know, there I am out in South Central, and I quickly sort of got my butt kicked by how hard and complicated and difficult that work was, and I am very grateful for that butt kicking. And in the humbling experience of being a teacher in the early 90s in L.A., I got to know a lot of people that I would not have had access to. And the most instrumental were the parents of the kindergartners that I taught at the Charles B. Barrett Elementary School. And those parents were a little older than me, probably about 24, 25. Some of them had been teen parents, the younger ones. And they were amazing. I mean, they absolutely were amazing. They were trying to make it work. Some of them were involved in some real tough stuff, like gang involvement. Others were just trying to work multiple jobs to put food on the table in any way they could in a city where racism was largely unheard by the people in power. And so when that happens, you have establishments like traditional schooling that don't pay attention to the needs of black and brown children and X them out of the system. And these young parents were part of that. So it left me with two things. One, a very keen sense of where and how inequality happens in systems and how people do not know how to fight that, and a very huge faith in amazing, resilient young people from urban areas like South Central LA that could, if they were given a vehicle, a transformative vehicle for change, so if they were given a runway to get their education, to get a diploma, I thought they could be such an amazing asset to those beyond their immediate community. the state, the country, or more. We just had to change the system to be able to really listen to these kids.
Well, and you give great credence here to parents, too, and something that that not enough people do. The notion that those young, often teen parents from at-risk backgrounds could make decisions, which some people just go, oh, no, they can't possibly do that. We've got to create the school for them. How did you see that?
Well, I will say, 20 years later when I decided, or 18 years later when I decided to become a parent myself, it was the lessons that I learned from that classroom and those parents that taught me the most. You know, showing up for your kid, believing in your kid, they are the most unconditional love people. I'm not a huge believer in unconditional love, but I was then, and I am in those folks. And so just because you might participate in some more nefarious activities, usually because of poverty or a combination of poverty, education, and lack of role modeling, does not mean that you are necessarily a bad person or a bad parent. In fact, it can be quite the reverse. And so if it's the traditional and sort of monolithic structures involved in education that are keeping you away, then it's our responsibility as people with access to change that. And so that's what I endeavored to do. So when I brought the idea of Phoenix was probably born there, even though I wasn't aware of it. Eventually, I made my way after the LA riots back to the East Coast, went to grad school and started working with gang-involved young people and their girlfriends or partners who are often, not that gang-involved young people are exclusively male, but I did a lot of teen pregnancy prevention work, teen parent work, a community organizing initiative in Chelsea, Mass. Around immigrant parents that wanted to build their own agency and voice inside of traditional school systems. And that's where I got to know the community of Chelsea. And I heard about a fellowship that was inspired by, launched by a woman named Linda Brown, which is now called Building Excellent Schools.
The famous Linda Brown. It's fantastic.
The famous Linda Brown. And she gave me a chance in 2003, and she said, well, I like your ideas. They're a little out there. You know, traditionally the charter space in Massachusetts has not served these young people. And I'll back up. I didn't start charter schools because of a big belief in charters. I actually just wanted to do what I just talked about. I wanted to say, like, could we create a school from the ground up that really tailored itself around the needs, both the needs of young adults, but also the resiliency factors that they carry in urban areas, particularly children of color, and see what happens. Like, could we get them to college? Nobody was asking that question. People were shuttling off-track, what we call now off-track young people, into GED programs, which were never supposed to serve 15 and 16 and 17-year-old kids.
Right.
They were supposed to serve, it was a post-war thing for Vietnam vets, you know, or perhaps earlier than that. And so this, you know, or they were shuttling them to really bad alternative programs because district superintendents didn't know what to do and they didn't have the resourcing or the ability within a traditional teachers union contract to be able to serve the needs of these young people. And so I said, well, the charter movement is public. It allows access and autonomy. And if you screw it up, you don't get the right to continue. So I'm like, well, that's great. You can do something, have the freedom to create, co-create, in our case, with young people and parents, and have accountability buffer to make sure that we're doing right by kids.
And not just send them off to GED programs, but do
right.
What? Like, you just had a graduation. So let me just back up for our listeners. So 2006, you founded Phoenix Academy in Chelsea, Massachusetts.
Yes. Yep.
And you've grown to a network of three schools that are challenging more than 500 very resilient, as you call them, disconnected students, typically disconnected students with rigorous academics. And some people said it couldn't be done. And you just had a graduation, I understand.
We've had one of three. So we graduated seven kids from one school in our first year, and now 12 years in, we will graduate 70 students this year, and our total is about 373 grads across the Phoenix network of schools. And they're all off track. Many of them are 20 and 21 years old, and they are all doing it. Our college, our one-year college persistence rate, it hovers around 75%.
Which is dramatically higher than even affluent four-year college goers today.
Right.
Which is extraordinary.
That's persistence. Now we're going to tackle graduation rate. But you're right. It, people said it shouldn't be done. Even people that love me and believe in what we're doing, we're like, you'll be closed in 3 years because nobody will. And think of these stereotypes, Gene. Like, people said, no one will work for you and children won't come. So think of what's under the hood of what those things mean, even from well-meaning progressives, right? And it was... it was challenging for me, also being a well-meaning progressive, to kind of say, wait a second, like, what is it about these young people that we would say they can't do it and want to shift them into low-performing, low-expectations programs when we know that it's high expectations that works to put these kids on the map? We need them in the workforce. We need them leading us.
And I was suspecting people on both sides, right? So suspecting kind of like, as some of us call them, from the limousine liberals to the conservative head in the sand people, no one thought charters could actually help these poor low-income kids. I still have people saying to me all the time, oh, well, if the parents were better. I'm like, really? Because my parents, the people that I know that are actually from my community, don't necessarily know more than the poor low-income parent who's making a choice.
Totally, and sometimes less. It is not about the parents. And in Phoenix, it's led pretty firmly from a place of respecting the voice of parents. The value of ours to really listen to anybody that's going to be, we call people adult supporters, because sometimes it's not a traditional parent. I'm not actually a traditional parent myself in terms of being a birth parent. And so, but I'm parenting three children that are mine. And I have a certain zealot-like sense about that. If there is a person who has shown up as responsible for a young little life, and they want to nurture and grow that life, we don't have the right to judge them in the way that they're doing it. We do have the responsibility to work with them and learn together about how to best put that young person, you know, through some post-secondary education, college, or training that's going to give them economic viability. And Phoenix has become very ardent in the idea of, you know, how economic viability happens for off-track folks of color in particular, and folks in urban communities, and, you know, and how we can make those pathways really accessible to young people, whether they're a newcomer from the country. In our Chelsea school, we're now serving 62% of our students are newcomers to the country, so they've been in the country for a year or less. We have a huge immigration rights movement happening inside of our Chelsea school, and we're graduating kids, Gene, in 2 to 3 years who didn't speak any English when they came in, and all they want to do is stay in this country and contribute and be like a vital piece of what we do. And so that's been super inspiring. We're going to graduate about 20 students from that program tomorrow from that school. And we figured some things out. I mean, students want to succeed. They want a high bar. They want people to trust them, to care about them, to listen to them, to listen to their stories. And we are really guided by that. You know, we are guided by what they're saying they need.
Give me one of your favorite student stories from recently.
From recently. So in Lawrence graduated 26 students, mostly young men of color, last Thursday. And the sort of closing speaker is a young man named Anthony Horton. And Anthony came to Phoenix 6 years ago. He came to open the school with us and took a real chance on, you know, a school that nobody in Lawrence had heard of. And it was we ran a charter-like school in a district, so we were part of the district turnaround up here. Mm. Anyway, he did it. Like, he definitely was not on track to even be able to go through high school, and he was able to finish high school, and he's enrolled at Northern Essex Community College. And in his speech, you know, which I'll send to you, you know, he said, I am part of this place. This place is a part of me. I am Phoenix. I know I can always come back here. And the fact that Phoenix is able to give a place of, like, love, support, pushing, et cetera, to young people that can turn it into something that, you know, in their lives would have been a high school dropout, and they're turning it into, you know, graduation success and beyond.
Exactly.
And the ebullient look on his face, it was amazing. The newspaper has a picture of him, like, fist up, you know.
I will clip it.
Celebrating being a scholar.
We will clip it and share it with listeners. All right, so this is the really interesting thing. So you didn't just settle, and it's not even just settling. So many people, they start a school, and they're focused on the school, and they do extraordinary things in so many places. You also said, I want thousands more people to have this opportunity. So you joined with to help lead the Massachusetts Public Charter School Association on one hand to help the other charters. You also were at the helm of an initiative which a lot of people still don't know about, and it is a cautionary tale, but it was an initiative to lift the cap last year, a year and a half ago, on charter schools, painful for many people working around it. But there's kind of two Massachusetts, right? There's the one that said, we're great, we love it, we live in Concord, we live in all these other beautiful places, we don't need anything, thank you very much, we're listening to the Massachusetts Teachers Association. And then there's the other that said, no, we need more opportunities. By the way, they're not just for at-risk kids, but let's help everybody who needs and wants the best fit. It failed. Right. And I'm still struck by that, as should most people, particularly in an election year when I believe that everybody should be going to the polls, not with party, but thinking about issue.
Yeah,
so what happened? I mean, really, in a nutshell, why is it important to you that you crusade as well for more opportunities for kids? And what do we need to know coming off of the Proposition 2 debacle?
So, I mean, I'll back up and say that my reasons for going from outside of the school to becoming part of the Mass Charter School Association, which is our association that sort of protects our funding and our sort of right to be here in Massachusetts, I wanted to give back because that association had given a lot to me and its leader had given a lot to me as an early charter school founder. But my motivation was really more selfish. I felt like the sector of public charter schools in Massachusetts anyway, needed to know how it could really push its own boundaries and that a school like Phoenix could be successful also for these young people. And I think we've really done that, Jean. Like, charter schools in Massachusetts, first of all, we're at the top of the game in the nation in terms of results, academic results for young people. But we also are exploring how to use, like, restorative justice in our sort of citizenship, or some people still call it a discipline program. We are collaborating with districts to learn together about how to solve statewide issues like, you know, how to better serve immigrant and refugee young people. And, you know, we really and there are schools that serve high-risk kids that are not necessarily Phoenix, which means more and more schools are thinking, how can I, in this more traditional public charter school, think about serving lots of different young people? Our serving special education rates skyrocket, English language learner education has skyrocketed inside the Massachusetts public charter space, and that has been incredible. And I think Phoenix had a little bit to do with that. It was a small exemplar of what you can do with a really good autonomous system. I actually don't even think that should be just charters. There are a lot of urban superintendents that would like the autonomies that public charter schools have here.
Of course.
So I really wanted to push that heavily. And so that has been good. In terms of question two, I think that was a really good, you know, fight for young people for all the right reasons to try to give young people more access. When you have public charter schools in Boston and in other urban areas where you have thousands of kids on a waiting list saying, please let me have this shot at a great education. And when there was a parent from Brook Charter School that said at one of the sort of rallies that we were at, and she said that her local school had been judged as mediocre. And she said, my child deserves better than a mediocre education.
Mm-hmm.
And so until that changes, you know, then I need access to public charter education. And that's why I support lifting the cap. And that's certainly why I did my small piece of leadership in that effort. We were bested by an extremely powerful Goliath in the teachers union. And that I think there are many, many great teachers in public district education. In fact, my mother-in-law and my sister are both really proud district teachers in one of the local communities outside of Boston. And I have great respect for that. But they are not the largest voting bloc in unions, and they, I think, often don't know everything that all of the political machinations that happen inside of the union space.
Well, and that's such a great
that's
point.
That's certainly bested us.
Yeah, yeah, and so really the lack of information, the ability of that Goliath, the teachers' unions, to reach people more quickly and easily, you know, right at a touch of a button because they have access to those teachers with information, lots of misinformation that we all heard. You know, it makes me wonder about your thoughts on what could be a decision any day now from the Supreme Court. So I want to really talk to you about this because, again, you are like so many people in the education, I call it now the opportunity space, not so much reform.
Mm-hmm.
You are one of many, many diverse voices. I think that's what we enjoy and appreciate so much about being in this space is that there's so many different viewpoints. But Janus versus AFSCME, they're going to hand it down as I speak to you now in June, any day now. Maybe by the time people hear this, it'll be handed down. This could very well be a pro-worker freedom decision. And in response, the NEA and many state unions are needing to cut their budgets because they really anticipate that given the option, people aren't going to stay in. What's your feeling about that?
I hope that there are progressive leaders inside of the union space that would view this as, if there is a win, which I hope there is, that this could be a sort of a democratic renaissance, you know, because it allows teachers to have control over their own money, you know, which I think is essential. And it also allows the unions to take stock of, if there is a loss or a drop-off in membership, then they can take stock of, like, what is the agenda that the members want? Right? What are members interested in that they're going to, the active classroom teachers, whether they've been there a year or 25 years, that they are saying is important, right? And then the union does what I think is what all unions, you know, my dad was a very ardent union iron worker where it was really important to be part of the union. I was the union rep for the Charles B. Barrett Elementary School for kindergarten. And I think when people have, you know, your dues should be, you have your own choice, and then you have your own voice to be able to say, this is what's important. And that's part of our American process, right? So I think it'll be really interesting if unions can then react and say, okay, so this is what our members want. And if that, in that kind of situation where it is clean and active classroom teachers are really making the decisions, and then they say, we want to work on, looking at charter schools differently, then I'm actually more okay with that. Then I feel like public educators are having an honest, transparent dialogue that has been chosen by the people that have elected these folks. Right?
Well, and we're always talking about transforming education. This gives them an opportunity to transform themselves. I mean, to your point, unions played an incredible role for a long time in many industries. In some, they still do. And the teachers' unions has failed to keep up. When the National Assessment of Educational Progress comes out and finds just pathetic achievement among our kids, they either zip their lips or they say it's simply about money. Meanwhile, when your kids in Boston public charter schools are excelling, the comment is that you must be creaming. And so that can't continue to occur, and you're right. Maybe there will be, because of generational change or appreciation or progressivism on some level, both conservatives and liberals, they'll stop up and say, okay, we want to be an association the way that was intended. Maybe we don't need the union in the way it was once constructed. We have indeed advanced. We can actually talk to people, you know, beyond a phone call. I'm hopeful that would be the case. And so this decision is happening this year. It's a big year for that. It's a big year for you and this school. The other big thing happening this year is the 25th anniversary. Again, you're in Massachusetts, Beth Anderson, founder of Phoenix Academy. 25 years since the Massachusetts Education Reform Act was passed. A governor named William Weld got that done. You have a governor named Charlie Baker who's been incredibly supportive of the same reforms. It's very unusual, though, don't you think, to have a governor that into education?
It is maybe unusual for Massachusetts. It's not unusual for Bill Weld or for Charlie Baker. I mean, the governor here now has been a real advocate for, particularly for young people that feel like they don't have access or access in the right ways. Like, he wants to change have the system evolve to be able to serve them better, right? And he wants to try to eliminate barriers to that. And he's deeply interested in that space. And I appreciate him greatly for that, and willing to take, willing to put muscle behind things like receivership or turnaround, money behind autonomous efforts of district schools, and money and other support. And you know, he's been a great advocate for us, and is really faithful, particularly to off-track young people, not just in charter schools or at Phoenix, but also in the vocational educational space. He feels like that space is under-tapped and can really go the distance, and has put a lot of thought and energy there. And they have a lot of similarities to the public charter space.
It's a great point, and it just again goes to show you that these issues don't have to have a political partisan twinge to them. In fact, they're very. If you run, I think the lesson for Massachusetts is if you run and win on educational change and transformation, It doesn't matter what party you are, and I think that's a lesson that more and more people need to hear. Okay, in our last little time together, let me just ask you, Beth, where, I mean, you know, your website says where most academic stories end, ours begin. You guys have changed so many lives. What are the next dozen or so years look like for you in Phoenix Charter Academy?
Well, with the help of the Barr Foundation here in Greater Boston, we have been able to really take a deep look at where we are succeeding in cohorts of kids and where we are not. And we have started a three-year initiative called Phoenix Forward. We're actually going to change from a traditional standards-based instructional program to a competency-based program. And that's going to allow a lot of flexibility for our students, particularly off-track students that have to work or are older or maybe don't need all the credits and can apply some credits from their prior places in different ways. It's a project-based kind of atmosphere. And so we are starting, we've done designing for 2 years, and we're going to do implementation over the next three across our network. And we're super excited that we're going to be able to serve a lot more students and make that college entry number a lot bigger and therefore make the college graduation number a lot bigger. We want to have tons of those stories, Jean, for you to talk about, of young people that have made it all the way through college. We have a lot. We want more.
Well, the key is that
things to do it.
That's fantastic. The key is now competency. I am so happy you're moving towards this. I can totally tell.
Absolutely.
I want to have you back really soon to talk more about that and other stuff.
I'd love to.
You are such a fantastic guest, Beth. It's been my pleasure to have you here on Reality Check. For my listeners, I've been talking to Beth Anderson, the founder and CEO of Phoenix Academy Network. You can find out more about them at phoenixcharteracademy.org. Follow them on Twitter at Phoenix Charter. As usual, check in with us anytime, and don't forget to subscribe. I'm Jeannie Allen.